All right, welcome everyone. Today we're going deep into the world of SAP PP production planning and, specifically how it all ties back to all of you, our amazing SAP pros, keeping our ECC 6 system humming. We've got this, it's a pretty big project on the horizon, right? Implementing SAP PP in that brand new process production facility that's coming online. And that means, of course, new products. And, this is a big shift for us, moving away from the assembly lines we're used to. These new products, they're going to be variant configurable, a whole new ball game in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And that's exactly why we're here today. But let me be clear, this isn't like, one of those hands-on training sessions. We're not going to be walking through transactions step by step, and there's no system demo on the agenda. This is a deep dive. We're going to explore the core of SAP PP, the principles, the theories, the explanations behind everything.
The why behind the what, so to speak.
Exactly. And we're going to do it in a way that directly relates to your work, to this new project, and to the intricacies of process manufacturing.
Perfect. Let's get started then. So, I guess the best place to start is at the very beginning, right? We need to understand the foundation of it all. And for SAP PP, that's MRP2, Manufacturing Resource Planning 2. But, MRP2 didn't just appear out of thin air. It actually evolved from, a simpler concept called MRP Material Requirements Planning. What really sets MRP2 apart is that it takes this much broader, much more integrated approach to the whole planning process. It's not just about materials anymore, it's about the entire system.
And if you look at the steps in MRP2, you really see that integrated approach in action. It all starts with sales planning, right? That's where you project how much of your finished product and your spare parts you're going to sell. You can do this at different levels of detail, from broad product groups all the way down to specific materials. And you can plan across different time horizons, whether it's weeks, months, or even quarters. Then you move into operations planning. Here, you determine the production quantities you need to hit those sales targets. And this is where things get interesting. You can use tools like coverage ranges or defined production intervals for a more, realistic plan. And then you have these things called rough cut planning profiles. They give you a quick, high-level assessment of your resource needs, so you can see early on whether your plan is even feasible given your capacity.
I like to think of those rough cut profiles as a sort of reality check. Early on, you can see if your big picture resources, entire production lines, or those key pieces of equipment, whatever it may be, if they're even going to be enough for what you're planning to produce. That early check can even lead to going back to sales and saying, hey, maybe we need to adjust the targets a bit, or maybe it highlights some bottlenecks where we need to invest in more capacity. So once you've got those sales and operations plans giving you, a solid set of production volumes, that's where demand management comes in.
And demand management really answers a very specific question. How do we translate those, those maybe high-level plans into tangible production requirements? It takes that sales and operations plan, which might be pretty broad, and breaks it down into detailed requirements for each individual material. And this breakdown, it doesn't have to be even across the board. You can, for example, use historical consumption data to distribute the demand more realistically. And then, once you've got those planned independent requirements for each material, the system compares them to any existing sales orders. And this is where the planning strategy you've configured for each material really comes into play. It defines how and when that comparison happens, which takes us straight to planning strategies and this really crucial idea of the order penetration point.
This is where things start to get interesting. We're talking about that point in the value chain where a real live customer order comes in, and that's what kicks off the whole procurement and production process. Anything before that point is based on, estimations and forecasts. It's like a push system trying to anticipate demand.
Absolutely. And the source material, it lays out these four main planning strategies. The simplest one is make to stock. With make to stock, you procure and produce all your components and the final product based purely on those forecasts. The goal is to have finished goods ready to go in the warehouse, ready to be shipped out as soon as an order comes in.
So the focus is on efficiency. You can produce components in bulk, keep your machines running, and generally you can offer shorter lead times.
But as you can imagine, the risk here is overproduction. You might end up holding too much inventory, especially if those forecasts aren't spot on, and you're not very flexible if the market suddenly shifts. Now, for a simple product with stable demand, like, I don't know, those basic bicycles in the example, make to stock makes a lot of sense. But for our new products, the ones that can be configured in all sorts of ways, we need to be very careful.
Yeah.
Holding excess stock of even a single variant can tie up a lot of capital. So we need to be really sure about those forecasts.
Okay.
Maybe we need to look into integrating our plan forecasting even more tightly with sales and operations planning.
And then we've got assemble to order.
Assemble to order. It's all about mitigating that inventory risk from make to stock. You still plan and procure or produce your components based on forecasts, but you only assemble the final product when you have an actual order in hand.
So you're not stuck with a warehouse full of finished goods that might not sell.
Right.
Especially important when you have lots of different product variations.
Exactly. But of course, your assembly process needs to be super flexible to meet those delivery promises. Then there's make to order. Here, you only start producing once you have that customer order, even if the design is set and your manufacturing processes are well established.
So you're really only keeping raw materials in stock.
Yeah.
Lead times are going to be longer, but you eliminate almost all the risk of having the wrong finished goods sitting around.
Precisely. This strategy, it requires flexible machinery and a workforce that's ready to go when an order comes in.
And then there's the most customer-centric of them all, engineer to order.
This is where you don't even finalize the product design until the customer places the order. Everything is tailored to their specific needs. It means long lead times, obviously. And planning those delivery dates is really tricky because, well, you don't know exactly what you're building until later in the game.
And even procuring components is risky because you might need special materials with long lead times once that design is finalized.
Right.
And conveniently, Table 1.1 in the source material, it gives us this really nice summary of, you know, how these strategies stack up in terms of lead times, inventory risk, and production flexibility. So when we, you know, when we talk about make to stock in the SAP system, what are some of those key settings that actually make it happen? Is it in the material master?
Yeah. There are a few key things to look at. In the MRP1 view of the material master, you've got the MRP type. For make to stock, that's usually going to be a forecast-based planning type. And then in the MRP3 view, you have the planning strategy group. This links the material to a specific strategy. For make to stock, you'd often see something like planning with final assembly.
Okay.
There are also settings in the MRP3 view that control how those planned independent requirements are consumed by sales orders, things like the consumption mode and consumption period. But I think the really crucial question for us as we look at this new process production facility is which of these strategies, or maybe a combination of them, is going to work best for these new variant configurable products we're going to be making. The bicycle example in the source material, it gives us a good picture of how these strategies play out in a traditional assembly environment.
Makes sense. And of course, all of this planning, it relies on good master data. That's the foundation, the information about the materials, the production processes, the resources we have. It's all there in the master data. So let's start with the material master, the heart of it all.
Yeah, the material master is where you define everything about a material. It's got a ton of parameters that control how things work across the entire company. What I find really useful is that the material master is organized into these views. Each view focuses on a specific area, like design, sales, production, accounting, you name it. Some views are company-wide, while others are specific to certain organizational units, like a particular plant or purchasing organization. And for production planning, those key views are the basic data view, the MRP views, the work scheduling view, and the forecasting view.
Right. So the basic data view, that's where you find, you know, the really fundamental stuff, the material number, the description, unit of measure, weight, dimensions, the basics.
Yeah.
And like we saw in the example with the bicycle, ETF WT500, when a new product gets designed, it's usually the design team that kicks things off. They create that basic data view using, I think it's transaction MN01.
Right.
And then later down the line, the work schedulers or the MRP controllers, they come in and handle those production related views like the MRP and work scheduling views. But let's talk a little bit more about those MRP views.
Yeah, the MRP views, there are four tabs there and they are super important. They control how a material is planned and procured. This is where you set things like, do we make it ourselves or buy it from someone else? Do we plan based on forecasts or actual consumption? How big are our production or procurement lots? Mm. And is this material for a specific customer? Or is it going into general stock?
Mm-hmm.
We saw in the bicycle example how they define things like the MRP type, the MRP controller, lot sizes, the procurement type, which was in-house production, storage locations, production times, goods, receipt times, planning strategies, and those configurations for consumption.
Lots of details.
A lot, yeah. And then there's this really handy concept in SAP called MRP profiles. They let you group together common MRP settings into these default values. So when you're creating a new material master record, you can just assign a profile and boom, all those fields get populated automatically.
It's all about making life easier.
Right, exactly. It streamlines the whole process of creating and maintaining those material masters. Yeah. So much easier.
And once we have those materials defined, we need to figure out what goes into making them. That's where the bill of material comes in.
Right. The bill of material, BOM-BOM, is basically a structured list of all the components, the subassemblies, the raw materials, everything you need to manufacture a finished product. Mm. And the source material, it explains how SAP actually recognizes several different categories of BOMs. You've got material BOMs, which describe the structure of a material, document structures for complex documents. Mm-hmm. And then order BOMs and project BOMs, those are specific to sales orders or projects. They allow for, you know, customer-specific modifications. You're all pretty familiar with material BOMs from our current assembly work, but in the new facility, we'll be working with recipe management in SAP, which uses these things called master recipes.
Okay.
They're kind of like a BOM, but they also tell you the process phases, the control parameters. It's all in there. It's a lot more dynamic, you know, much more suited to process production.
So it's like a BOM, but with more steps, more details about the process itself.
Exactly. But, you know, for our discussion on production planning, the material BOM is still a good starting point. It's got a header with basic information, things like the base quantity of the finished product and who's responsible for designing it. And then you've got the items, each representing a single component.
Right.
For each component, you specify the material number, the quantity, the item category. Is it a stock item? Is it variable size? And a bunch of other parameters.
Now, one thing I always found interesting about BOMs is that you can define certain values, like component scrap, both in the material master and the BOM.
Right. And if you do that, the value in the BOM always overrides the one in the material master.
So it's like a more specific setting tailored to that particular BOM.
Exactly. And it's super helpful when, say, a component has different scrap rates, depending on how it's used or what final product it's part of. Like, they show us in the example, when you create the BEM for the bicycle, the ETF WT500, using transaction CS01, you link everything together, the frame, the wheels, the pedals, the chain, the gears, everything. It's all there in the BEM. And then, of course, we have the difference between the material BEM, which is specific to a plant, and the group BEM, which isn't tied to any specific plant and can be used across multiple locations.
Okay, next up, we've got the work center. This is where the rubber meets the road. It's where the production actually takes place.
Yeah, it represents where the work happens, whether it's a single machine, a workstation, a group of machines, even a whole department. Mm-hmm. And every work center is assigned to a specific plant. But what's really key here is the connection to other modules, especially CO, cost accounting, for tracking costs and activities, and HR, human resources, if you're dealing with, you know, labor costs in your work center.
Right. So it's not just a standalone thing. The work center is connected to the bigger picture.
Exactly. And when you define a new work center, there are a lot of settings. You have the work center category. Is it a machine? Is it labor? Is it a machine group? This determines the overall layout and what parameters you can set.
Okay.
You also define the basic data, things like who's responsible, where it's located, the standard value key, which defines the activities relevant for scheduling, capacity planning, and costing, like, you know, setup times, processing times, labor times. Then you have default values for those activities, capacity information, scheduling parameters, and of course, costing details, like the cost center and activity types. They show us all these settings in that example with the welding work center, ETWC01, in plant 1200.
Lots of moving parts.
Definitely. And lastly, in our tour of the essential master data, we have the roading.
This is like the detailed instructions, the step-by-step guide for how to make a product.
Yes, it tells you which operations are needed, where they happen in the work center, and the exact sequence they need to be done in. It's crucial for planning and execution.
Right. And the source material talks about these four different types of task lists for routings. Mm.
Yeah, you have standard routing specific to a material used for discrete production, reference routing, which isn't tied to a specific material, and is used for recurring steps. Then there's rate routing, which is material-specific, used when you plan based on production rates. And finally, reference rate routing, which combines both. Now, because we're focusing on discrete production here, the standard routing is the one we see most often.
Okay.
A routing, it has a header with all the important data, the plant, the status, the planner group responsible. And then you have the sequences of operations. The standard sequence, that's the normal production flow. Parallel sequences are for operations that can happen at the same time. And alternative sequences, well, they give you different ways of doing things. Each operation tells you the work center, what the activity is, the standard value key for cost tracking, and the control key. The control key, that's a big one. It controls how the operation is handled. Like, is it done in-house? Is it outsourced? Does it generate capacity requirements? How is it scheduled? We saw this all in the example where they create a routing for the bicycle frame, the ET Ton 11. It shows the welding, the cooling, the painting, all at work center, ETWC01. And you also assign components within the routing, linking those materials from the BOM to the specific operations.
Got it. So now that we've laid that groundwork, let's shift gears a bit and talk about the differences between assembly production, what we're familiar with, and process production, which is what that new facility is all about. I mean, the bicycle example, it's a classic case of discrete manufacturing and assembly. Process production, it's a whole different animal.
It really is. I mean, for starters, process production often relies on formulas and recipes to define how you make something, not those traditional BOMs with separate components you assemble.
Right. And instead of those clear sequential operations you find in a routing, you often have phases or process steps that might overlap, happen continuously, or be managed in batches. It's not as tied to those individual production orders like you see in assembly.
Yeah, and we also have to deal with byproducts and co-products, which you don't really see as much in assembly.
Yeah.
Even the work centers are totally different. Instead of assembly lines, you're talking about specialized equipment, reactors, mixers, filling stations, things like that.
Right. So all those differences, they have a huge impact on how we set up our master data in SAP. I mean, the material master, for example, might need specific views that are relevant to process industries, things related to managing and controlling those processes.
Yeah. And those BMMs, we might have to replace them or at least really expand them with recipes. Recipes that not only list the ingredients and their amounts, but also all the critical process parameters, the conditions, how long things need to run, all of that.
And the routings, they'll look different too.
Absolutely. They need to reflect the actual flow of the chemical or physical process, not just a series of distinct assembly steps. And like we talked about, the work centers will represent that specialized equipment used in process manufacturing.
But it's important to remember that the core principles of planning, those don't go away. We still need to know what materials we need, when we need them, and if we have the capacity to make everything. It's just the way we capture and manage that information within SAP PP. That's what changes.
Exactly. The principles stay the same, but the implementation and the master data, they need to adapt to the unique demands of process production.
Makes sense. So as we look ahead to this new facility, there are a few specific challenges I think we need to be prepared for. The first one that comes to mind is costing and controlling. In SAP, that's COPC. And, you know, process production, it just adds a whole new layer of complexity to cost accounting that we don't typically see in our assembly operations.
Yeah, it makes you think, how are we going to accurately track the costs of these new process manufactured products? Right now, with assembly, we rely a lot on production orders as our cost objects. With process production, we might have to shift to process orders or even batch-level costing. And then there's material valuation. It gets much more complex when you're dealing with semi-finished goods and trying to figure out how variant configuration affects inventory valuation at different stages of production.
Okay.
Activity-based costing, that's another one. We'll need to configure that carefully to reflect the specific activities that are typical in process manufacturing. And even the way we calculate standard costs, we might need to use different approaches for process flows.
Right. And the source material, it does touch on cost accounting within the work center. They mentioned the costing view, the linked CO, and how we define activity types. But I think the takeaway there is that we'll definitely need to define a new set of cost centers and activity types that really capture the specific chemical or physical processes we'll be doing in this new facility.
And what's really interesting is how this all ties into variant configuration. Each variant might need different raw materials, different process steps, and that means different costs. And those cost variations, they impact everything. Costing, profitability analysis, even how we price those different variants. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure those cost variations are accurately captured in the system and reflected in our financial reporting and our pricing strategies.
Absolutely. So challenge number two, and this is a big one, is material management, specifically inventory and warehouse management. And, you know, those variant configurable products, those really throw a wrench into the works. It's a whole different ballgame from managing those standard non-configurable items we're used to.
Yeah, managing so many different variants creates a ton of new challenges.
But like for starters, how do we even set up these configurable materials in the material master?
Right.
I'm thinking we'll need to use generic articles, variants, characteristics, classes. It's a whole different way of thinking compared to our discrete assemblies. And then how do we track the inventory for all these variants. Do we do it at the generic level, or do we need to track each individual variant? That decision has a huge impact on how we count stock and how accurate our inventory records are.
And then there's warehouse management. How do we store and retrieve all these different variants? Our current warehouse setup, it might be designed for a much smaller number of standardized products. We might need smarter put-away and picking strategies to handle all those variations.
Makes sense.
And it's important to remember that the source material, it doesn't really go into the nuts and bolts of variant configuration.
Yeah.
So we'll need to rely on our general SAP VC knowledge and figure out how it all fits in with our material management processes.
Right.
We'll probably still use those same goods movement transactions like MyGo, but the logic behind figuring out the materials and quantities, that's going to get a lot more complex with all these configurable products.
Mm. And the third challenge, sticking with material management, is that some of these new products, they can be both semi-finished and finished goods in the system. It's not about the product itself, but about where it is in the production process.
Right.
That dual nature, it creates a bunch of new inventory management headaches.
For sure.
How do we define them in SAP? We need to pick the right material types that work for both production and sales.
Yeah.
And when we have demand for a product that can be either semi-finished or finished, how does SAP know which type of stock to use? We might need to set up some specific rules for that. And then there's tracking the movement of these materials between those two states.
Right.
How are we recording those internal movements within the plant? Maybe specific movement types or special stock indicators, something to differentiate those two states of the same material. And how does all this affect planning? How does the system plan for materials that could be used in different ways?
Yeah, the source material mentions material types. They talk about finished product, but they don't really dive into this whole semi-finished, finished thing. This is where we really need to get that material master set up right. We might even have to use different storage locations or stock indicators just to keep things straight. And our planning strategies need to be robust enough to handle that flexibility.
Okay, so wrapping things up, we've covered a lot today. We started with the fundamentals of SAP PP, that whole MRP talk framework, the different planning strategies, those key master data elements, material masters, bills and material, and of course, recipes and process industries, work centers and their equivalents and a process setup and routings and how they relate to process flows. And then we talked about that key difference between assembly and process production and what those differences mean for SAP PP. And finally, we looked at those three big challenges: costing and controlling in a process environment with variant configuration, the impact of configurable products on material and warehouse management, and how to manage materials that can be both semi-finished and finished goods.
And I really hope this deep dive has given all of you, our SAP experts, a good theoretical and principle-based understanding of SAP PP, especially in this new environment we're moving into. We want to build on the expertise you already have as we tackle this project together.
Absolutely. This is just the beginning. We encourage you to explore these concepts further in our ECC6 system. Spend some time with those transactions, those master data objects.
Yeah, this is a starting point. As we move into the implementation phase, you're going to have a lot more specific questions, and that's great. But keep these principles and concepts in mind. They'll help guide you as we work through those details together.
And to leave you with something to think about, the foreword of our source material, it really emphasized the importance of flexibility and responsiveness in production planning, especially in a market that's constantly changing.
Right.
So how can we take those principles and apply them to our new process production facility with all its configurable products?
How can we make sure we're ready to meet our customers' needs no matter what they throw at us?
That's the question to keep in mind as we move forward. Thanks for joining us on the deep dive.
Thanks, everyone.